Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I love to laugh. Loud and long and clear.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, a family meeting about laughter.
It's getting worse every year. The more I laugh, the more I fill with glee.
It's not a family meeting about jokes, although we will invite you to tell some jokes later and be judged by a jury of one John Hodgman. It's a family meeting about laughter. How we laugh at silly things like that song from Mary Poppins, or at much more serious things.
And people will think before they kill somebody if a bullet costs $5,000, man, I would blow your head off if I could afford it. I'm gonna get me another job, I'm gonna start saving some money, and you a dead man. You better hope I can't get no bullets on layaway.
Thank you, Chris Rock. And listeners, if you are someone who tries to be funny for a living, like Chris Rock, Chris, you can call, why did you turn out to be the comedian in the neighborhood? 212-433-WNYC. Why are you the comedy writer or the joke teller or the cartoonist when other kids on your block grew up to be lawyers and artists and engineers? 212-433-9692. Contribute to our family meeting on laughter on The Brian Lehrer Show today. Our first guest is Scott Weems, author of the book, Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. It's a new book. Scott Weems holds an MFA in creative writing and a PhD in cognitive neuroscience, a true double threat when you go to grad school for an MFA and a hard science degree. Scott, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Are you kind of a left brain, right brain switch hitter?
Not only that, but my specialty in cognitive neuroscience is right brain thinking. So I guess so.
There you go. So you argue in your, which you use your left brain to, never mind. You argue in your book that laughter is our natural response to conflict and confusion in our brain, confusion that can be cognitive or emotional or social. And that sounds like a pretty serious neuroscientist grounding for why we get silly. Why conflict and confusion in our brain?
Well, I really think it comes down to the fact that we laugh at a lot more than just straight jokes. We laugh at awkward situations. We laugh the first time we meet a stranger. We laugh sometimes even at dark events, like, you know, it's called gallows humor, where you might laugh at a funeral or a sad movie when you know you have conflicted feelings about what's happening. And part of the reason why I wrote the book was me and my cousins, we laughed at my grandfather's funeral because he was such a lively man and he was so jovial, and it, the somberness of the situation didn't quite fit, and so we all felt these conflicting emotions. And I think that's a common experience, to not sure how to take some situation. And some, like you said, sometimes it's emotional, and sometimes it's cognitive or social.
And you're right that humor also results from a conflict in our brain between feelings and thoughts. Why between feelings and thoughts? Or maybe that funeral example was a good one.
Yeah, I mean, we very seldom are you just approaching a situation one way. I mean, every situation is emotional to some extent. And I mean, another example, it was two events really that made me want to write the book. The other was my wife laughing at the end of Titanic, which makes her not sound very, very sensitive. And she's not happy I shared the story. But as Leonardo DiCaprio was dying near the end of that movie, and everybody in the theater was crying. And I think that's just that was the normal reaction for that movie.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. Okay, so in case you didn't know, Leonardo DiCaprio doesn't make it in the end.
15 years ago.
Yeah. So in case you didn't know, I'm sorry. But so he drowns, and my wife laughed. And I looked to her, and why are you laughing? And she said, "Yo, Adrian," in my ear. And it was awkward. And she just felt that, like, James Cameron, the director, was playing with her emotions and treating that climax like he did Terminator or Aliens 2, just with nonstop emotion, and she felt manipulated, and she rebelled. Because
right.
That's what
she does. And she was back a layer or two from it. She was laughing at the filmmaking, not at what's happening to the character. So is this a good example of the conflict between feelings and thoughts creating the opportunity for humor? Is this a good example of this classic moment under extreme circumstances when Mayor Rudy Giuliani visited Saturday Night Live producer Lorne Michaels on the Saturday after the 9/11 attacks. Listen.
Having our city's institutions up and running sends a message that New York City is open for business. Saturday Night Live is one of our great New York City institutions, and that's why it's important for you to do your show tonight.
Can we be funny?
Why start now?
Why start now? Do you know that moment from Saturday Night Live on September 15th, 2001?
Yeah, classic moment. That was when Saturday Night Live came back after the terrorist tragedy of 9/11. And yeah, I mean, that was an awkward moment because nobody really felt like they had permission to laugh yet. And so I think that was necessary to make the show a success.
It was both funny and addressed the topic of when we're allowed to laugh and be funny in the face of tragedy and devastation and have fun in the face of tragedy and devastation without dismissing it. And we'll hear more examples like that coming up. And again, listeners, if you are someone who tries to be funny for a living, why did you turn out to be the comedian in the neighborhood? Did it have something to do with some conflict or confusion in your brain? 212-433-9692. Why are you the comedy writer or the joke teller or the cartoonist when other kids on your block grew up to be the lawyers and the artists and the engineers? And tell us what you think drove you to that desire. If you do stand up or write comedy or draw cartoons with the hope of making money at it, what drives you to think funny? Was it a conflict in your life that your humor seeks to resolve? Is it a confusion in your brain, as our neuroscientist guest Scott Weems asserts? Some of you can probably use that as material. So why did you grow up to be the comedian in the neighborhood? Contribute to our family meeting on laughter on The Brian Lehrer Show today with Scott Weems, our first guest, author of Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why. And Carol in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Good morning, Carol.
Hi, good morning. Actually, first, thank you to Scott. I heard him interviewed not too long ago, and his book just came through Amazon, so I'm really looking forward to reading it. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're his publicist,
oh, yeah.
Right?
Great.
Yes.
Thank you.
Anyway, so I have a whole history in stand-up. I became a stand-up when I was about 19, actually at the same time as Sarah Silverman. She were in, and I were in college together. At NYU, but I had like a whole history of being bullied like mercilessly through pretty much my whole childhood. I had no ability to stand up for myself. I was always told not to hit, so I was pretty much a punching bag. Then somewhere, I guess in my senior year, I figured out how to have a comeback. Like a kid said, you know, you look like a cow when you chew gum. And I said, well, you don't need to chew gum to look like a cow. Not much of a joke, but it was like, oh, like he was like, oh, gee, maybe I better not make fun of this person. So
humor gave you power.
Exactly.
Over
humor
a bully.
Is very powerful because it's a way to actually attack from the inside. Because if you can get the other guy laughing, they're incapacitated in a way. In fact, research bears this out, that you really, when you're laughing, you can't do anything else. You know?
Fascinating. And we will hear later in the show from Liz Winstead, who's coming into our studio, co-creator of The Daily Show, as some of you know, who's currently using humor as a means to fight for abortion rights, of all things, that you think might not be funny. So maybe that's along the same lines as Carol. Carol, thank you for starting us off. Scott, what about that notion of humor giving you power over the bully?
I think it's fantastic, and I think it makes a lot of sense, too, that if you can make a quick comeback, and if you can throw out that quip, you're in a sense asserting power again. As you said, power is a great word to describe it, and that you're kind of showing that you're smart. You can think on your toes, maybe even quicker than the person that's insulting you. And so, if somebody throws out an insult, there's not much to that. It's just it's just a throwaway phrase. But if you can throw out a joke, that's kind of telling someone that you not only understand their insult, but you can one up them intellectually. And I think that's why humor is so linked with intelligence and creativity and these other higher cognitive functions. It's a sign, whether you're defending yourself from bullies or in whatever context, that you've got a brain that can kind of keep up and is worth fighting for.
Hugh, on the Lower East Side, you're on WNYC. Hi.
I am indeed. How are you?
Okay. So you do something funny for a living?
I do indeed. Well, I'm afraid it's not a living yet. I suffered a severe brain injury in 1987, and for many years I operated a nonprofit drug and safety education program. I toured the country speaking in schools to kids about brain injuries and drug abuse, and then I developed a stand-up routine, and I moved to New York. I switched over careers because my love was photography.
And so what role does the humor play for you? Does trying to do comedy and teach comedy play for you? What do you think drove you to do it based on the experience of the brain injury that you mentioned?
Well, as your guest said, there's a major the reason I began is because of the conflict between who I was before my brain injury and who I was after. The essential conflict was I graduated from the UCLA Theater Department in 85. In 87, I suffered this brain injury. And the conflict between the person I was and the person I am now or was then in my rehab was devastating. It was just, and the best way to deal with it was by laughing and finding humor in it.
It's incredible. It's such a courageous story. Hugh, thank you very much. Have you heard things like that, Scott? I mean, it is. It's, you know, talk about higher order thinking to respond to that kind of devastation in your life by finding the humor in it and pursuing that track as far as you can. I mean, it's incredibly courageous.
I think it is. I think wow, what a great process. And I think humor is a great tool for him and everybody to use. If you want to improve your communication skills, if you want to just generally be out there, humor is a great way to do that. And I think that's why if you look at some comedians who you don't – we didn't necessarily take Steve Martin or Robin Williams all that seriously until they also showed their expertise in dramatic acting and music and these other areas. And I think it's a shame we don't consider comedy and humor as an art that – you can practice, and it shows that you're sharp. You have a lot to contribute and share, and so I can't think of a better way to address these life changes that Hugh's gone through than to do it on the stage. I think it's a great way to get the brain going and get that process of recovery going.
And here's another example of humor in the face of something entirely unfunny, also health-related. This is from a now-beloved stand-up that Tig Notaro did just a few days after learning that she had advanced stage breast cancer and after her mother had just died.
Somebody over here just keeps going, oh. Oh, I think she might really have cancer. Who's taking this really bad? Oh, it's okay. It's okay. It's gonna be okay. It might not be okay, but I'm just saying. It's okay. You're gonna be okay. I don't know what's going on with me.
Tig Notaro, some of you may have heard that on This American Life. What would you say, Scott Reams, that Tig Notaro moment tells us about the outer limits of humor in our lives?
Yeah, it certainly shows how it's not necessarily the topic which brings the humor. It's how you address it. And there's a saying that if you want to make a point, tell a story. But if you want to make many points at once, you tell a joke. And I think when you're joking about something like cancer or these other very serious topics, you're not making fun of the disease. You're actually trying to take power over it, and you're saying something else. And I think maybe in her humor, she's saying that really you can take ownership of your own life. It's not a disease that is going to end your sense of humor, your ability to joke or interact with people or do any of these other great things that you want to do. And so, I think that's why you see humor in such unlikely places, not just in hospitals, but war zones and other very serious venues, is because, there are times you can laugh or you can cry, and I think laughter is a much better option.
It's a Brian Lehrer Show family meeting on laughter today. We'll continue with Scott Weems and talk next about the demographics of laughter, and we'll take calls next. Let's clear the board from all of you trying to make a living at making other people laugh, and take calls from anyone about laughter and your culture. Is Jewish humor different from Christian humor? Is American humor different from European or Latin American or African humor? We'll hear some facts from Scott Weems' book that indicates that it is in many cases. And let's make this one of our immigrants from anywhere call-ins. If you came to New York from India or from Iowa, from your experience here compared to wherever you grew up, what makes Americans laugh and what makes people in the New York area laugh compared to where you came from? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And then later, John Hodgman will be here to judge your jokes as a jury of one John Hodgman as our Brian Larichelle Family Meeting on Laughter continues. It's a family meeting about laughter on the Brian Lehrer Show today. Recognize that classic Monty Python moment? Still with us, Scott Weems, author of the book, Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why, new book. And as we turn to the demographics of laughter, we again invite your calls. Calls from anyone about laughter and your culture. 212-433-WNYC. Is Jewish humor different from Christian humor, different from Muslim humor, etc.? Is American humor different from European or Latin American or African humor? We will hear some cross-national humor comparisons from our guest in a minute. Let's make this one of our immigrants from anywhere call-ins, too. If you came to New York from India or from Iowa or from anywhere in between, from your experience here, compared to where you grew up, what makes Americans laugh? And what makes people in the New York area laugh compared to where you came from? Can you put some words around that idea? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So, Scott Weems, have you ever seen one of those laughter yoga videos on YouTube from India?
Oh, yeah. Laughter yoga is a huge thing now and growing all over.
Here's an example. As a form of yoga, folks, if you don't know about this, of meditation, of tension release, some yoga teachers will get large groups of people together. The video will sample from Now, which I watched last night, seems to have dozens of people in the group, maybe hundreds, and they consciously begin to laugh and see what happens. Here's a little of how that sounds. Laughter yoga from India. It's contagious to me, too. I think all the Indian Muslims will have to try that now to cope with the election of Modi. But that's another show. Scott, you write in your book about a laughter epidemic. That's kind of a created laughter epidemic. I think you wrote about a spontaneous laughter epidemic that broke out in Tanzania that spread from a few people to over 1,000 and lasted for 18 months, you say. What actually happened?
Yeah, crazy event. It's amazing. We don't hear more about it now, but this was quite a number of years ago that in Tanzania, then it was called Tanganyika, a few schoolgirls just started laughing, and then their friends started laughing, and pretty soon it wound up overwhelming most of the country. And as you said, you know, over 1,000 people affected. They had to shut down schools, and in the end, they didn't know what happened. It just kind of died out on its own. And there's a lot of interpretations for it. One is just some sort of mass psychotic illness. But I think it's a little deeper than that because there's a reason that the children laughed versus did something else. I don't know, just collapsed maybe. So I think they laughed because this was an incredible time of social change for them. Schools had just desegregated. They had just shifted from European to local rule. Religions were changing. And add to that the fact that these were primarily young schoolgirls entering puberty, which is a pretty big change in itself. I think they just didn't know who they were anymore, and so they laughed, which is what we do a lot of the times in our life. If we're not sure what to make of something, we tend to laugh. And I think that's why laughter is so contagious, is because we share these social awkwardness moments.
All right. You have some demographics of humor in your book. Let's go down some of these as calls are coming in. And again, folks, the invitation is for immigrants from anywhere to our area. Compare what makes people laugh where you came from to what makes people laugh here, if this is a difference you've noticed. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And, ooh, I think Elias in East Harlem is actually on to a point that Scott makes in his book. Elias, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Where are you from originally?
I'm actually Ethiopian originally.
Great. And?
And I seem to notice that over here people laugh at, you know, others' misfortune. Over in Ethiopia, people usually laugh at the misfortune on self, you know. So when I tell a joke about my misfortune, what happened to me, people laugh. But if I tell a joke about other people's misfortune, they don't. It's considered taboo.
Over there, but not here.
Not here.
Elias, thank you very much. And you've got that very thing in your book, Scott Weems, that Americans like jokes that include insults or vague threats.
It all comes down to the classic Mel Brooks line that if you fall down a manhole, it's funny, but if I do it, it's a tragedy. And that's kind of what it is. This is a very American humor trend. In a way, and there's actually been studies by a British psychologist, Richard Wiseman, who set up a website and asked people to rate jokes. And people from all over the world rated jokes. So he was able to get lots of data. And it turns out Americans like slightly confrontational humor. Their humor is social and not always in a nurturing sense. I mean, this is a broad generalization.
Sure.
But we see this, and I think that matches our society. We're kind of we're not a subtle society, Americans are, especially if you contrast us to like the British with the traditional stiff British upper lip, where it takes a lot to unnerve somebody historically, you know, if you're just going to generalize in that culture in the British Isles.
And so Brits, say in the book, prefer deadpan or irreverent humor. Was that Monty Python bit we played about the dead parrot an example of that?
Oh, yeah, that's so British, right, that he buys a dead parrot and tries to return it. And, yeah, classic bit. And you look at all the Monty Python skits. They're singing, always look at the bright side of light, but, you know, these dire moments. And the members of Monty Python actually sang that at the funeral. Was it Graham Chapman's funeral, I think it was?
Not sure.
Yeah, and so this is the very British wit. They like absurd and nonsense humor.
All right, listeners, compare what makes people laugh in wherever you came from, elsewhere in the United States or elsewhere in the world, compared to this country or this New York area, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Ceylon in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Ryan. I just want to say, like, where I come from in Guyana, people laugh generally at how you look. They give you like a name, like say if you're tall, they call you tall man. If you're short, they say short. Or you're fat, you have one. And when I tell my American friends that, they say it's so mean. But I let them tell them that people that you call a name, they laugh at it and they like fit so well in with everyone else. Like it's like nothing is actually wrong with them.
Ceylon, thank you very much. Interesting. So Scott Weems, author of Ha. Yeah, we've got Americans like jokes that include insults or vague threats. Brits prefer deadpan or irreverent humor. And then you go on to say, different from Americans or Brits, continental Europeans prefer their jokes absurd or surreal. Like what?
Like an example?
If you have one.
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. So a dog walks in a telegraph office and wants to send a message. And the telegraph operator says, okay, what's your message? And the dog says, okay, I want to send woof, 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 woof. And the operator says, that's only 9. You know, you can send a 10th woof for free. And the dog says, but that would make no sense.
That one could be in the New Yorker.
Yeah, it's okay not to laugh at that because it's weird for the sake of being weird. I mean, that's a longer version of like the joke. A duck is floating on a pond next to his friend and says, quack. And the friend says, I was going to say that. I mean, these jokes, I laugh at them because I love them, but they're just weird, and they don't always connect with an American audience like they might with a continental European.
Absurdist humor. And you quote the playwright, Edward Albee, absurdist playwright, who said, I have a fine sense of the absurd, but no sense of humor. Was he just making a joke or some kind of real distinction?
Yeah, I think he was making a distinction. I think you're always, when there's a joke, there's always a subtle message behind it. And I think there is a message behind that we like to be shocked. We like to have a destination, too. So we like to, you know, have some new way of thinking that comes from our humor. But sometimes absurd humor, the point is that life isn't always clear and isn't always pat. And that's kind of the subtle message of the joke itself. And we don't necessarily follow that so much in the United States, but in other cultures they do.
Mary in Manhattan, originally from an exotic, faraway land. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'm from Minnesota.
And?
I've been here for a long time, and just to let you know, my friends tell me I have no sense of humor. But when I listen to Garrison Keillor, it cracks me up. And I haven't been in Minnesota for years.
What do you find funny about Garrison Keillor? I mean, you know, of course, so many of our listeners listen to Garrison Keillor and laugh at Garrison Keillor, but can you put it into words as a Minnesotan?
Well, he gets the accent, and then the things that they worry about, you know, that his fictional characters worry about and how they react to life. And also when I read George Bernard Shaw, because I'm Irish, Norwegian, that mix of people from Minnesota and Irish humor also. When I read George Bernard Shaw, I just crack up. But when I listen to Monty Python, I don't get it at all.
Huh.
So I think it might, you know, there is some cultural kind of aspect to humor.
Thank you very much, Mary. Sarah in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
You lived in Italy?
Well, yeah, I lived in, you know, the States for 20 years, and then I lived in Italy for 20 years.
Uh-huh.
And I remember in particular when I, you know, first got there and was learning Italian, and it was frustrating not to understand the jokes. And I wouldn't laugh, and everybody else was laughing. And then when I started understanding them, I didn't laugh because I didn't think they were funny. And it was a really hard moment because the humor is just completely different. It's
Can you put it into words?
Yeah, I think it's much more based on sexuality and vulgarity. And it's very much more so than it ever would be accepted in the United States, I think. And maybe with all of our political correctness and, you know, feminism and all that, there's so many things that Italians find hysterical that just would not be acceptable here at all.
Sarah,
but I have to say that after 20 years, I still don't find much of it particularly humorous.
So, Sarah, thank you very much. Does that ring true to you, Scott Weems?
It does. To me, and this is more of a personal relation to it, is that I look at, you know, the vulgar humor, and sometimes cursing falls in that too, is kind of the percussion section of communication, in that it's, I mean, there are times when there's profanity or vulgarness in jokes, and I think it works. It's funny because it's part of the overall orchestra of the joke. But just like a kid at a set of drums just throwing out, you know, just hitting things, it can be jarring and not necessarily musical, to continue the metaphor. And so there are times when, for me, I think you can say things in humor that would be socially inappropriate if it's part of a larger message that is not vulgar in itself. But just like hitting drums with no pattern to it, it can be pointless, and it's not music, it's not humor, it's just being vulgar, and so that's where the art comes in, and it's very difficult to draw that line.
Some more demographics of humor from your book. You have a number of gender distinctions. I think these all come from the same study, but women tend to be more open to humor than men. Really? Someone tried to measure that?
Yeah, this is, of course, very difficult to measure. And when you say more open, it depends on how you look at it. Women laugh more than men, if you just look at laughing. And we know because scientists have just gone out and eavesdrop on people and found that women laugh maybe twice as much as men. Put two women in a room, they're about twice as likely to laugh as two men.
When it comes to sense of humor, though, women are outnumbered than men in professional comedy, although that's changing each year. More are getting involved in humor and professionally, and I think that's a great thing. So that might just be a social. For a long time, women weren't raised to be, you know, comedians.
And this study noted that women tend to laugh less as they get older, while men tend to laugh more as they get older. Is that because men are in denial?
It might be. It tends to be in communication that men tend to be the ones making the jokes and women tend to be the ones laughing. And so it could just be like what we would call in science a high base rate, that women just by nature would laugh a lot. So it's kind of only got one way to go as they get older. And men, they're a little bit quicker to withhold that laugh. So maybe that's where that's coming from. But it certainly isn't that women have less of a sense of humor, because you can look at the brains of men and women as they're processing jokes. And it's certainly not that women are not engaged by humor. I think it's probably just how people are raised.
And as you said, women laugh more on average, according to that study. And finally, religious people, according to a study, have a poor sense of humor compared to non-religious people. Really? Who measured that?
Yeah, this was tricky. That was, I'm going to butcher the name, but Vasily Saraglau, I think, is how you pronounce it, from France. And these were rather religious people. I think it wasn't from a monastery, but it was a group of people who dedicated themselves to religious study and found that the more devout they were, the less social they were in their humor and the more self-deprecating they were in their humor. But, I mean, that's tricky to generalize to a broad population from there. There are studies to show that we tend to like that absurd humor that we were talking about more, less, as we get older and we become more conservative.
Huh.
I don't know if that's directly linked with religion, but I think if you put these findings together, you can just generally say that the more you feel like you shouldn't laugh, you should hold it in because it's the proper thing to do, the less you're going to laugh and the less you're going to share that humor with others. And I don't think that's always healthy. And I don't think that either society or our religion expects us not to laugh. I think laughter is a healthy thing.
Less laughter among the religious. That is a cruel joke by God played on his adherents. As we conclude this segment on the demographics of laughter with Scott Weems, neuroscientist. His new book is called Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
As our family meeting on laughter on The Brian Lehrer Show today continues.